there's a great white chart up. You've got about 5 seconds. You can change your mind. You can answer as many times as you want. You're all taking part in the Mass Mobile experiment. I know it's late in the day. Next thing is the after-show party, so we're going to keep this light. We've got a lot of mobile games, so I hope your phones are charged, and I hope you get the right answers. What makes Node.js blazingly fast? Is it Google's V8 engine? Is it the single-threaded architecture? Is it the non-blocking event loop? Or is it all of the above? Asking the audience, we've got a dead heat, C and D. Single-threaded architecture, are you guys sure? It's not the single-threaded architecture? That was an evil laugh. Okay, and the answer is D, all of the above. In what year did Atari first release the game Pong? Okay, so we've got a few old people in the room. 76, 72, 81, 64.
Oh, they just changed their idea.
Okay, answer was B. Question 6. What was the original name of the team that developed Windows NT? The Code Monkeys, the Portable System Team, the Avengers, or the Portables? Code Monkeys is looking pretty good.
Oh.
Ooh.
Boring.
Number 7, how many lines of code in Windows XP? 1.5 million, 15 million, 45 million, 90,000.
900.
Windows XP was my favorite operating system for about 3 years.
Boring.
We're up to C, 45. Okay, all the Aussies out here, I don't know this one. What's the fastest speed a red kangaroo can hop on two legs downhill? Getting chased by a bigger red kangaroo on two legs down a hill. 65, you think so? 70, 65. Question 8, Rolling Stones' favorite song of all time, best song of all time. If you guys get 100% on this, I will sing the song, and I am. I'm a really bad singer. So we've got Bob Dylan versus the Beatles.
It's a big spread.
Here we go. It's A. Question 10. Where was Lady Gaga born? She born in Mars? Was she from New York? Was she from Wollongong? Or was she from South Fork?
Last chance.
So it's neck and neck. We're saying what? Answer is Mars. How many paintings did Vincent van Gogh sell during his life?
None.
So let's see, what are the stats, Simon? What are the audience saying?
Oh, none. Not very commercial.
Ooh. Answer was B. Question 12. We're nearly there, guys. Don't worry, it's not 6 million questions. So what's the chemical symbol for the element gold? Is it Geo? Is it cha-ching? Is it GD or is it AU? Don't make me say cha-ching again. AU. I thought that was Australia. Okay, 13, unlucky for some. What does a hippopologist study?
Hippologist. Hippoologist.
Horses, herbs, hippopotamuses, or hip-hop dancers? Herbs. You guys sure? Herbs?
I thought it was horses myself.
I thought it was horses. I think it was bug. How many Harry Potter books are there? And this is not a trick question, so we want to know Harry Potter books that have been written, they're completed, they've been sold. You can go and buy them in the shops. I don't want to hear any excuses about secret Harry Potter books that haven't gone to market yet. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer is something or other. C, okay. Final question, guys. Where is the Node.js source code freely available from? Is it up there on GitHub? Is it open source on CodePlex? Are the folks at Joyent open sourcing it? Or what about Nojitsu? What do you guys think? Okay, and the Yeah, it's got to be GitHub, doesn't it? Okay, so that was the first part of the Mass Mobile experiment, and now we're going to kick into the presentation. So all of the technology you're going to see here today is developed for mobile phones and for any internet-enabled device. We're using Windows Azure to power a Node.js server, and you guys are all communicating with the server in North America in real time. So my name's Aidan. I work at MYOB.
I'm Simon. I'm also at MYOB, and our story began kind of a couple of months ago. You can follow along. All the slides have a follow along notes as you go, but try to keep your power up because you might need it at the end of the presentation, all right? So the story began where we were both separately, Aidan works in Sydney, I work in Melbourne, we were both separately working on Node things unbeknownst to each other. MYB, we use Azure, and we were trying to work out which Azure installation, data center, is fastest from the various cities across Melbourne, Australia and New Zealand, and which ISP. So we set up these servers in Node and had clients through web browsers all hidden them, and we sent it out to hundreds of our clients to see and start to map out the geography of the performance. So we were kind of getting into Node. That's what I was doing in Melbourne, and in the meanwhile, Aidan was in Sydney doing something similar.
Yeah, so Windows Azure announced support for Node last November. So Node came out on Linux originally, and it was rewritten and ported to Windows late last year. So I started to tinker around, I started to play with Node, and I thought it was really good fun. So JavaScript on the server side is very liberating. You don't have classes and interfaces and layers and big constructs that you're wrestling with. It's all very, very lean code, but it's difficult code to write. It's asynchronous and it's non-blocking, so it's a bit of a mind shift, but I find it very, very liberating and a breath of fresh air from doing some C#. So yeah, I started doing a few talks for some of the Azure user groups demonstrating some real-time chat applications that I was building and running on Node. And yeah, I got chatting to you, Simon, and we both realized we had a bit of a passion and a side thing going on for Node.js.
And we decided, okay, we'll do something for TechEd, right? And we think, okay, what can we do? We started tinkering with WebSockets and mobile browsers, and this is all going on for about a couple of days, maybe a week, and then suddenly I get this phone call. Panicked Aidan calls me up. Simon!
So I was watching SBS. I was watching a program called The Day the Computers Took Over. And this guy's head cropped up on the screen. And his name is Lauren Carpenter. So he was a developer, and he's a chief scientist and one of the founders of Pixar. And back in 1991, he conducted an experiment in California. And it was an experiment into the crowd swarming. What Carpenter did was he invited 5,000 people into an auditorium, and he didn't tell them a thing about what they were going to do there. Do you want to continue the story, Simon?
Yeah, so he had them, it was dark, they all entered the auditorium, they sat down, it's kind of the lights are all dim, and on their seats was a paddle with a red side and a green side, and no one knew what was going on. And then somebody lifted up into the sky, their paddle, and they saw on the screen like a little floating light appeared. And so other people started doing it, and they started moving around, and they realized that the crowd was actually controlling what was going on. Then Lauren puts up on the screen a game of Pong. And his idea was to see what happens when people self-organize. And he didn't tell anyone the rules, and he didn't tell anyone how to play, and the whole place started to self-organize into how to actually play Pong. And they had to actually collaborate greens and reds to balance out where the paddles were going to go. And the whole thing erupted. We've got a bit of footage here. Can we switch to that footage?
We'll get straight to the footage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Happened in that group of people where some decided to show green and some decided to show red to cause it to stop in the right place. And we have no idea what did that.
Carpenter believed that what he had created was a model of a society where there was no hierarchy.
Okay, so I saw this on TV, and I just jumped on the phone and I said to Simon, I don't care what you're watching, I don't care if it's MasterChef or Dexter, turn to SBS, you got to watch this.
It was Dexter.
It was Dexter. Yeah, because we started to think about how can we recreate Carpenter's experiment but put a modern spin on it. So we don't need to give you guys paddles. You've all got an internet device in your hands. We don't need to give you red and green. We can use the tilt on your phone, we can use mouse touches, we can use motion detection or clicks. But we could recreate Pong, and we could reconstruct that same experiment and see if people can self-organize with no hierarchy, no rules, and come to a common goal and play a game of Pong. Okay, so this slide here is going to talk about the conceptual architecture. So this is the platform that we've built. So clients on the left-hand side are all your internet-enabled devices. So this is your mobile phones or your iPads. And clients are connecting to the server in Azure, running Node.js over web sockets. So each of your phones has got a permanent connection with bidirectional communication to the server. We've got a control panel in the middle, and the control panel lets us twist all the levers and adjust the send frequency from the client to the server. We can throttle the server if it gets very, very busy and bunch up the messages so we pass them more smoothly to the play fields. And the play fields on the right-hand side are where the apps run. So the first app we had today that we showed you was the quiz. The second app we have is Pong. And we've built a whole load of apps that all run on this architecture. And that's what this picture here is describing.
So when we watched Lauren and we saw what he was doing very simply, he actually had a few experiments, right? He had some voting and stuff. But we realized that, you know, this technology is actually an amazing enabler for a situation where you've got a big screen and lots of people. It's a shared experience. It's like the difference of watching a DVD one night, going to work the next day and saying, hey, who watched that DVD last night? Right? No one did, right? But if you go to work, if you're at home and you watch TV and you watch Dexter, the latest series, or the latest episode, and you go to work the next day, you say, who watched Dexter last night?
I don't watch Dexter.
There are a couple of sickos in your colleagues who would have watched it, right? It's that shared experience. And, you know, how people in a big audience, and you can think of some crazy audiences, right? Imagine the AFL Grand Final. They've got a massive screen there and 90,000 people, right? What can you do when you bring all those kind of people together, and what can you do with the technology? And our goal was not just to do Pong with the mobile phone, but really to build in the middle here a generic server. So our goal was, how do we make a plug-in architecture, a really, really lean and scalable server in the middle, and allow anything to be made, and what would the server look like? And we're telling you today a little bit more about what that experience was and what happens inside these components to make it kind of semi-generic.
So before we got in there and started cutting the code, we started to brainstorm a few ideas. So we just thought, what could we actually do with this technology? And those of you following along on your handsets, you'll see some of the wacky ideas we came up with. So look, we knew we had to build Pong. We had to bring Pong because Carpenter was the inspiration for this experiment. But then we started to get a little bit more out there. So we spoke about a maze where everybody on their phone would solve a little piece of the puzzle. And on the big screen, you'd see the whole grid. What were some of the other games?
I got a list here. On your phones, you can see. We had a Tetris, and we had a tug-of-war game where you have to collectively move your handsets the same direction to kind of pull the rope from the other half of the team. We wanted a game where everyone had a single presence on the screen, which is very hard when you've got hundreds of people, so we didn't actually know how to do that in the end, but some kind of capture the flag game we invented. We didn't actually finish it. We just kind of more about a thought experiment. And for each of these thought experiments, we worked out what would the server need to do and what would be the minimum, most generic thing that the server needed to do to support a game like that. We thought about maybe having a bouncing ball that you have on your handset and you can bump it to the person next to you, and you can pass it around, and maybe it's a hot potato, a giant memory game where you click and where you guess the matching card is that are on a series of cards on the wall, and we also thought maybe we could fly real helicopters with everyone helping to control them, but that got a little extreme. But
yeah, so that was the blue sky day, and that was us just imagining, and then we started to think about what would all the APIs look for those games, and we narrowed it down to a generic set of API calls, and that's what we built on the server.
All right, but now we want to run another little experiment with you guys. This is going to be another kind of game, so get your handsets out. We also need two volunteers. We need two people. We're going to be having a debate, and we need someone to help us feed us information. What kind of people do you want, Aidan, or just one person?
I want one person in the audience who's passionate about C-sharp and object-oriented programming.
Just to whisper in his ear some ideas. Who's any C-sharp coders here?
Anybody
come
like
on.
C-sharp?
We won't embarrass you. Come stand up, please. What's your name? Wahid, come on here. This is Aidan. Thank you, Wahid. Welcome. I need somebody who likes JavaScript, who likes dynamic languages, is not a fan of type systems. Java, C#, and not. Come on, anyone want to help me? I need a helper. Come on.
This is Tech Ed, Simon. You're on your own.
I'm a loner. Is that what you're saying to me? Nobody here. All right. Yeah. Thank you. What's your name?
Jason.
Welcome him up, Jason. Thank you. Welcome. All right. Let's do this. Everyone, get your handsets out. we're arguing for. Dynamic languages are better than static languages. Okay, okay, so what's my arguments I need to have?
What's the argument going to be?
What's my argument?
You don't need to worry about talking. So you have to cast.
Yes. That's much better. Okay.
Okay, so with an object-oriented language, and C-sharp is my favorite language, the compiler does all the hard work, yeah? You build an interface. You check it in. You've got your namespace. Then the compiler checks at compile time if you've got any typos.
Make sure you've written
the right code.
Aiden, if you think the compiler is going to save you, then you're a loser of a programmer. Seriously, you should know what types they are. You should know what functions you've got. If you named all your variables nicely, then you wouldn't have to worry about all what types they are.
What else can you do?
I'm winning.
You can run it quicker.
Static code analysis. So you check the code in. If it's a strong type language, I can run all my static code analysis tools over it.
I can check for
cyclomatic redundancy.
Coding is way faster with dynamic languages. There are no multiple layers and interfaces. And if you want to add one function, one thing to the database, you've got to change like 7 layers. Come on, give me some more votes for that one. It's a good one. Jason's not working.
IntelliSense. Do you guys have IntelliSense?
We do. Of course we have IntelliSense.
Partial IntelliSense, but seriously, if you need IntelliSense because you've got 1,000 objects and 1,000 layers and you've forgotten which ones are where, you should simplify your
architecture. Sorry, excuse me, we've got a question. What's partial IntelliSense? What is partial IntelliSense?
It can spot some of the functions, not all the functions.
So I reckon if you haven't got the mindset for object-oriented programming, you can always do dynamic coding. You can make it up on the fly, you can hack it together, 2 lines of code and you've built something that's slightly reusable, but no one's going to reuse it.
Think about the productivity when you don't need to compile. Think about how much faster your build systems are. Think about how much faster your tests run. That's a tough crowd here, isn't it?
It runs on everything. It runs on phones.
Imagine a world where the compiler does all the heavy lifting, PCs. Where developers can't have a UI that goes straight to the database and corrupts everything because they have to go through all your beautifully architected layers.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thank you. Thanks, Guy. Thank
That's
you.
Great. Thanks very much.
Appreciate that. Okay, here is one slice. So this is we showed you how the clients and servers, etc. This is like, just consider one slice. We've got clients, they talk to the server, and they send messages to the play field, and messages come back. The interesting thing, this is every component here has a frequency and has time as it run in it. And because it's over networks, and because it's all running on different threads, etc., all the timings are different. So there's all these kind of frequency loops that get set up in a system like this. So the clients that you write decide, like with the controller for the worm, it sends periodically messages to the server. And so what the server does in the middle is it collates all those messages as they're coming in. So it's listening on the network, and it puts them into a big queue, and then periodically on another timer, it collates what it's got, aggregates it, and forwards it to the play field. And the play field also has timers. Right? When you're writing with JavaScript and these languages and there's user interfaces, everything runs on timers and threads. So it's also working on loops. And you know, you saw the worm very, very bumpy there. Lots of interesting dynamics set up, and that worm, if you touch nothing, the worm will kind of, you know, go on its own as all the frequencies kind of line up and then fall out of sequence like a piston's blowing on a car sometimes. So this is the kind of the main pipeline of things that kind of flow back and forth. And we set up the server so that the clients, there's a whole series of APIs between each of these that are kind of the standard set of APIs, and we built library files for them to communicate, standard messages, and then also a custom pipeline where a client can send a special message. For example, use that with the voting system. Like when you vote, you send a custom message through back to your playfield. And the system supports many clients and many playfields all at the same time, which is it creates some interesting opportunities.
So I guess just the other point out on this. What we found a real challenge around the frequency piece is that everything is single threaded. Yeah. So JavaScript is single threaded in the browser, and Node.js runs on a single thread in the server. And the game loop running on in another browser is also single-threaded. So there's a real sort of, there's a bit of black art there to get the stars to align, to make sure that the clients are sending data just at the right speeds, so that it doesn't back up on the server and that it passes through to the play fields. And then you can imagine that as you start to ramp up numbers of users, the frequencies in these numbers change. And they change very, very subtly. But unless you've got the ability to really tune up and tune down those frequencies, you can find that all the messages start to get backed up very, very quickly. So as we built out each of the games, we discovered that the frequency and the patterns that you need to send the messages between the client and the server, and between the server and the playfield, were very, very different. So part of the API that we built was that each game, when it starts up, it can tell the server what its default frequency is to transmit messages. But from the controller in real time, we can monitor the number of users and how busy the server is, and we can throttle or we can actually flood it and let more messages through. Okay, so next slide. So now we're going to do a bit of a deep dive into the client. So just a refresher, the client is what's running on all your handsets. So the client is it's HTML5 and it's JavaScript. Right? So we tried to set ourselves a goal here to write one client and one client that would run on every device. We didn't want to have plugins or apps that you had to download, because I think that would have taken away from the experience. And to be quite frank, I don't think people would download an app to play Pong at a keynote. But if you can just get up there and hit a URL and you're playing straight away, that's what we were aspiring for. So at the heart of this, it's accelerometer detection, and that's part of the HTML5 specification. But as we learned, as we started to hack our way through all the different browsers and devices, and new browsers and old browsers, you know, iPhones and Windows phones, HTC and Androids, we found out that the accelerometer detection isn't very reliable. So we got really good results on the iPhone, but with Windows Phone, for example, you can't actually hook into the accelerometer readings without writing some code behind. So we had to do a series of fallbacks. So we'll try and detect accelerometers. If we can't find an accelerometer, we'll see if you've got a mouse. And if you move the mouse, that's what we use to detect what your intent is. If you've got touch, we can pick up touch, and we'll use that instead. And if all else fails, if you click on the screen or if you click in your browser, that's what we fall back to. So we tried to build the best experience for each browser, but we just wanted to write one piece of code that would run on every device. And we nearly got there. But look, the biggest killer for us in the end was viewports. And a viewport is a special meta tag you put in the browser, which tells HTML how to render itself for different size screens. And we just couldn't find the right combination of viewports to work across every device. So the one area where we actually didn't stay pure to ourselves is we inject a slightly different viewport if you're on an Apple or a Windows phone.
Okay.
Are we doing the code?
Oh, yeah, let's do some code. All right, I'll switch.
Do you want to jump in?
You can go.
Okay. So now I'm just going to take you through a little bit of the code that runs on the client. So I think that the first thing to point out here is that we built a whole bunch of games, yeah? So we used a convention-based approach where each of the games is a plugin. And your handset that's running the game can discover games from the server at runtime, and it can pull down the HTML and load it. So we wanted to write the server once and not touch it, and then we wanted it so that other people can plug in and add other games, hopefully without touching the server.
Yeah, I'll explain this thing. So this the code you're looking at here is the JavaScript library that we supply to all game writers on the client side. And this is on the back end what it has to do. And so these are some of the messages that it has to deal with. You see the socket on, and the socket on change game and settings. That means it's got to listen for its socket, and it's got to respond to those messages. These are the web socket or long polling messages that come from the server. And they could come from the control panel, or they could come from the play field. They probably could come from other clients, but we never got that far with the architecture. And you'll see here the function at the bottom called change game. So whenever the client receives a change game, it must switch out its divs and put a new div in for the game. So there's a main div that's around everything. And this bit of jQuery, the .load, will go to the server. And we've got a directory on the server of all the different games. And each one's got a client and a play field and some controls, et cetera. And it will take it and it would plug in, remove the old one and plug in the new one. The stop client, each client that you write must have some functions to start itself up and shut itself down. And on startup, typically what it does is initialize variables, but also set up all its timers and all the set timeouts on the looping inside JavaScript. And so obviously, when you change game, if there is a current game already going, then you've got to ask it to stop itself and close down all its connections and everything it's doing. And then you inject the new code. And actually, that jQuery.load function, I've never seen it before. It's a little ripper. I don't know if anyone, has anyone here used .load? It's really sweet. You can just give it an HTML file with no HTML tags around it, just some styles and some divs and some scripts, and it'll just put it all in, and it'll run through all your scripts and does a pretty good job of that. So we actually found some weirdness in some cases with Chrome injecting canvas tags, and it would sometimes layer upon layer multiple canvas tags and not unload the previous one, which is kind of weird. We had it with the Pong game. It would have, we could see multiple balls running around in certain situations. So it loads in the next game, and then it calls init client and asks the current game, its API, to kick itself off. Change settings. So there's a whole bunch of settings that were the client support, and there's a whole bunch of settings that the server support, and a whole bunch of settings that the play field support, and they could ask each other to change their settings. For example, we wanted to make sure that as it scaled up to hundreds of people, that the frequency on the client, obviously the faster the client can send, the more responsive it is for a player. And some games require responsiveness. But also, the more each of the handsets are sending, the more traffic the server has got to deal with. And so if it starts to slow down, we can watch how big the queues are growing in the server. And as that starts to grow, and the time it takes to process a loop on the server starts to drop, oh, sorry, it starts to increase, we can send an admin message to the client to say, please throttle, i.e. reduce the amount of time, or sorry, increase the time between your sends to the server. Right, and you can do it in milliseconds, so it's, you know, but it makes a big difference. And so we kind of built these tuners into the system.
I just want to talk about my favorite line of code in this file. It's only one line of code, but it's really powerful. So we use a library called Socket.io to establish the WebSocket connection from your handset to the server. And if you look there on line 15, we go io.connect, and we connect on a namespace. So all you guys connect on a namespace called players. And we added an argument there that says when we disconnect, you sync that back up to the server. But one line of code, and there's a whole lot of heavy lifting going on there. So your browser connects to the server, and it goes through a whole handshake and negotiation process where your browser will say, I can support WebSockets, I can support long polling, I can support flash polling, I can support JSONP. And the server in Azure says, I can support long polling, but I can also support WebSockets. And the two guys negotiate up to the best level that they can both talk on, and it establishes a long-running WebSocket from your browser to your server.
Hey,
so
Aidan,
I just think that's really amazing that in one line of code, it's all been abstracted away.
Aidan, what's this line? Perform slow, crappy gyroscope detection.
Yeah, so
you wrote that one.
Yeah, that's one of my methods. So yeah, there's a bit of a story behind this. So accelerometer detection is difficult, yeah? And there's an event called something orientation.
Device orientation.
Device orientation, that's meant to fire when there's an accelerometer or a gyroscope present in the device. But what I've seen happening is, especially in Firefox, when you're running on Windows, that when a page loads up, this event will fire once, or it might fire twice, but it'll just fire with null accelerometer readings. So you can't actually rely on checking to see if that event fires to determine whether or not you've got an accelerometer present. So you have to perform a slow, crappy gyroscope detection. So what I do is I check to see if the event is fired, then I set off a little timer for 20 milliseconds. I check to see if it's fired again, and if it's all nulls, then I know that you don't have an accelerometer detected. So yeah, look, the name is what it is. It wasn't a very nice way of detecting it, but it works.
As a developer, you don't feel pretty doing those kind of things. All right, let me talk about this one. This is MMH. This is the client telling the server this is the client telling the library on the handset what it wants to listen for, right? So you say listen for movements, and you can pass in a series of callbacks of what you want to happen. So every game, depending on what data is coming through, will want to process and deal with that data differently, right? So with the political worm that you saw, that's like, you know, real data, right? Numbers between minus 90 and positive 90, floating point numbers. So you want to send your actual current value to the server. But with the Pong game, for example, it's an up and it's a down. So as you tilt and tilt back, you don't want to send all the real-time floating point numbers. You want to convert that simply to a plus one or minus one, right? So when you pass in a callback, you get an opportunity to pre-process the data before it gets sent off to the server for you based on your own handset. So this is how we actually start listening for accelerometers, we call it. Then we start listening for mouse movements, and then we register all the callbacks. And the whole system really is built around lots of callbacks. And people know that if you write JavaScript, callbacks are big. When you're writing Node, callbacks are even bigger, because everything that Node does, which is even slightly asynchronous, requires you to pass in a function that will be processed and a continuation of when it finishes, you'll be back on the stack, and then you'll be called, and you can continue. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff. You kind of got to get your head into that kind of model of thinking. And then obviously when the client finishes, it calls, stop listening for mouse movements. That's a part of its shutdown process. So the next game may not care about accelerometer readings, etc., right? So it says shut down, and let the next guy who starts up, let him do what he wants to do when he wants to.
Okay, so that was the client. The next thing we're going to talk about is the game loop. So, like, I hope you guys like the slides. I have to confess, we did some of them on the plane. We did some of them yesterday. We did a couple last night. I think we did our final builds about an hour ago. So, yeah, this one was drawn on a coffee table with a blue marker that I pinched from the speaker's room. That's right. Yeah. So, look, this is the game loop, yeah? So, or I beg your pardon, this is the play field. So just a reminder, the play field is where all the games happen, or where all your apps run. So the play field is running in another browser, and the reason we did that is we wanted the server to be really, really lean and lightweight. So all the server does is it listens for messages from the clients, it aggregates them, and it passes them onto the play field as quickly as possible. So when a game starts up, which is a play field, it'll tell the server, I want to listen for totals, I want to listen to every single mouse movement that gets sent up, I want to listen for aggregations, or I want to listen for custom messages. And then within that, there's a client-side JavaScript loop, which is your game loop, and that's where you plug in all your code.
Should we switch to some code?
Yeah, we got through some code.
Yep. Worm play field. All right, so let me talk about this one. Okay, so this is, we are now on the server side, we're now on the play field side, right? Normally when you develop clients and servers, you're in a different language on each place, right? Because it's all JavaScript, you've got to get your head back into where you are because it all looks very similar from a syntactic point of view, which has its advantages. Maybe you could say has its disadvantages. So these are all the APIs that when you write a play field, you must respond to. All right. So when it's a lot of people playing, people come and go all the time. And how you want to deal with that, you've got to work it out. You know, are they still in the running for the high score on the quiz game, or you know what happens? So you're given an opportunity here to deal with them as you need to, right? So new user is when a new user arrives. Wuss out is when somebody leaves the game, they wussed off. Position updates, total updates, there are various kinds of updates that a server can send. And this is a part, we'll get into this actually in a second, but as we started building games and tried to make sure that absolutely no game-specific code went into the server, that means we had to push it all off to the clients, and we didn't want it in the server because A, we wanted it to be generic, and B, we wanted it to perform. All right, so doing things on the server would have been much more efficient, but it would have compromised, I think, our architecture here. So that was one of our guiding principles. So these are, you know, shutdown, admin messages, initialize all the players, and then there's some custom stuff that you can write to deal with your own play field. And if you just go down to the bottom here, process. All right, so here is, this is for the political worm thing. Basically, it asks for the whole set of updates from the left-hand side of the auditorium, asks for the right-hand side of the auditorium, asks for all the counts, adds them all up, divides them all up. Everything was split in auditorium-wise on left and right side. That is an area that we wanted to improve on the next version. We found some auditoriums that were like, you know, could have six sections. So there's not left and right. You could potentially have six sections. We looked at maybe putting on everyone's chair a code or a QR code so that you could, you know, we'd actually know the position that you're in, and that would enable you to collaborate. We'd know who your neighbors were. And it was just an interesting kind of opportunity. So that's a bit of an area we want to work on next. Yeah, go for it. All right, so this is where, Aiden?
We are in the
playfield. All right, so this is playfield HTML.
No, this is playfield.js. We're up in the cloud now. This is...
So this is... Okay, so the server side has three modules. One for dealing with client requests, one for dealing with control panel requests, and one for dealing with playfield requests. And this is what happens. This is the main loop on the server that starts to process all the incoming messages from a generic point of view. And we brought it down to about three things that the server should do, which covered every single game we ever wanted to play. And I'd say every game we thought of, including the helicopter one. So one thing it is whatever the client sends you, whatever updates they've got, send them all to the playfield. Right? Just pass them all through. You know, who knows what the playfield want to do? It might want to do something crazy. It might want all the data. Fine, just give it everything it needs. Obviously, that one is going to be tough on performance because there's a lot of messages and it's all flowing in all directions, right? Second thing we wanted to do was to summarize everything. So just add all the values together, right? And then track the number of the count so that the playfield could do an average. And we saw the average in the worm. Those are the two main ones we had. And then only about a week and a half ago, we added a third one, which we think is probably the best one, which came out of trying to scale Pong. We can talk about that. Those are the unique totals or the running totals that we had on the server.
Okay, so we've spoken about the client, we've spoken about what runs on your handsets, and we've spoken about the browser where the game is running, whether it's Political Worm or Pong. So the final piece is the piece in the middle, which is the node server in the cloud. Yeah. So the node server is, we worked really hard on this to make it really, really generic, but to try and keep it as terse as possible as well. So we've got it down to 500 lines of code, which we're pretty proud of. And it's we've broken it out into three modules. So there's a module that serves the clients, there's a module that services the play fields, and then we've got a pipe in the middle to the controller from our control panel where we can orchestrate between the two. So the server, it's written in Node.js, and we have it deployed on Windows Azure. It's running on the metal in Windows Azure on a worker role, on a medium-sized worker role. The reason we're doing that is we wanted to support now WebSockets, and unfortunately, Node running out of, backed by IIS Node on an Azure website doesn't actually talk WebSockets. So we had to go closer to the metal and run it on a worker role. I'm going to take you through some load testing statistics later on, but the performance on this thing is it screams along. We got it up to over 2,000 concurrent users and 8,000 messages per second, and that's handling all of these WebSockets and concurrent connections. So the main responsibilities on the server is to queue up all of the messages that come in, aggregate them, and then broadcast them out to the play field as and when the timer has been set to do that.
Is there more code you want to go through?
Did we have a piece on the server?
No. Oh, that was that. We've done that one already.
That was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And change game. Okay.
Okay, so the question that might be on everybody's mind is why Node? Why did you guys build it in Node.js? But if you take a step back and look at what we've actually built here, it's an application that's highly concurrent. It's got WebSockets and real-time communication. And there's very little CPU that's going on the server. So for each of these messages that comes in there, we aggregate it to an array and we push it off. So it's high concurrency and a small piece of CPU, but lots and lots of I/O. So WebSockets and calling out from all of the players, passing on to the servers is lots and lots of I/O, and that's where Node.js really shines. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, no, it was absolutely the sweet spot. I mean, obviously, we just become off building two Node applications, right? Aidan and I in Sydney and Melbourne. So our heads were in the Node space. But when I look back on this and think, what does it do and what we're trying to get done, I cannot think of a better system for this. It is absolutely the sweet spot. When you read all the documentation of what Node's good for, long-running connections, right? People interacting a lot, lots of small messages, lots of bandwidth, very low CPU. And that was a goal, right, to get that's why we had to get the server down to not have any game-specific code in it. With Pong, it would have been much more scalable to receive all the requests from the clients, right, take all the paddle readings and all that, calculate where everything goes, calculate the ball position and where it's going to bounce to next, and just send the updates of where everything is for the clients to draw. Right, but that would have violated our genericity that we wanted on the server piece. Right, so that code all had to be pushed to the HTML browser-based clients to be processed, and that left the server with just these three simple things. What we ended up doing for Pong for the scalability aspect was that unique stuff. It's the running totals. So normally, what would happen was when we first started this thing, we thought this was the best bee's knees. Messages would come in, they would go into the queue in the server, and then the server would take the queue, empty it, and then send averages or send whatever the play field wanted, right? But then the queue would be empty. And so it would wait then as messages started coming in from clients again, it would come in, it would start to fill up, it would do the averages. And so the play fields were getting averages that were kind of brand new every 200 milliseconds. So depending on how the frequencies were all working, sometimes there were less things in the queue and it wasn't a representative of the average what everyone thought, over the last few seconds. So we ended up re-architecting that and adding a new model in the server, which was a running total. We call it the unique system, where the last thing the client sent to the server keeps track of. And if you send the same thing, it doesn't do anything. If you send a new thing, then it takes off the last thing you did, adds the new thing, and just has a running average or a running set of totals, and that's what it sent to the client. And that model, that small change, in fact, actually took us to the whole next level of scalability for the server, and it reduced the amount of processing it did, and it actually also increased the amount of performance we got out of the play fields. Because when you've got lots of things moving around on a web page, one of our initial experiments was to have the handsets, any way you move it, you were moving a live dot on the screen. And so we got up to, you know, 200 or 300 of these things, live moving from iPhones on the screen. But the bottleneck, we're like checking, where's the bottleneck? What's the server doing? Where's everything going? What's going on? And it wasn't the clients, obviously, and it turns out it wasn't the server, which we thought it was, and we instrumented the thing to the eyeballs to find out. It was actually just, it was the browser on the playfield trying to move around all these different pieces and draw it. So it was actually a client-side calculation problem. So those are the kind of problems we ran into on every game in every different way, and that's what kind of drove. And Aidan told you that the server is actually those three modules and the package system is only 500 lines of code. It was a bit bigger, but we kept on tuning it and bringing it down, saying, nah, that's not generic, that's a bit specific. Let's make it something a little bit more generic, a little bit more simple, and push it off to the play field and push it off to the clients to deal with. And so that's how we kind of refined the system over time. And Node was absolutely, absolutely perfect.
Right, so.
We absolutely did not.
How do you know that Node was best?
I don't know it was the best. I know it was a sweet spot for the way we wanted to develop this system, right? And so on paper, it's perfect. In reality, which system would perform better? I've got absolutely no idea. Anyone got any suggestions? What would be better than this, performance-wise? What's that? Assembly?
Erlang. Yes.
Erlang.
Erlang would be faster.
I'm sure there's heaps. Sure there's heaps of systems, right? I guess my point is what we did is textbook sweet spot for what Node advertises it does well, right? And I think as developers, we were very productive with this model just because the model matched what we wanted to do, right? And I've coded Erlang quite a bit, and you've got to get your head around that. And when I reflect, would this have been good in Erlang? Yeah, probably would have been damn cool, right? So maybe that's our next project.
No, I don't know about that. Yeah.
Any other questions?
I think this is everybody's favorite topic, load testing. I know as a developer, I'm fascinated by performance. How fast are things going? What's the CPU like? Where are the bottlenecks? Is my code actually executing and is it running properly? So there's a bit of a story around this. So about 3 weeks ago, we had put in our submission for TechEd, and we got the green light. We knew we were talking to TechEd, and we got a phone call from Michael, who's one of the guys who's setting up the keynote, and he asked for a demo of Pong, and he said, look, I think this is a really good idea. He said, we'd be really interested in putting it up on the big screen before the keynote. And he said, are you guys sure that it can scale to, a couple of hundred users? We're going to have a few hundred users playing this over Wi-Fi and on 3G. So, myself and Simon were on the call. We said, absolutely.
Yeah, this thing scales, absolutely.
This thing scales. It's sweet as it runs. It runs on thin air. So we got off the phone. We did a good sales pitch. And then, we got back on the phone, and we started to panic.
Because we knew it did scale. We knew it scaled to two.
Yeah. Not three. So I played with myself, my wife, and yourself on the phone. Right. So we got it to about three users, and we saw the CPU was pretty good. And, we've read all about Node. We know it's really, really efficient, and it does things really well if you don't write blocking codes. But how do you make sure your code isn't blocking? Yeah. So how do you know that all of the async calls that you've written don't block? And the only way you can do that is actually to throw a whole load of load at the server. So we started to think about how would we actually load test this, and we thought, we're going to build another game for this. So the load testing module and all of the stats I'm going to take you through now is actually another game, so it's another plug-in to the platform. And essentially how it works is that the client is a browser in this case, so we don't actually use a mobile phone as the client, we use a browser. And you launch a browser and you launch the play fields. So the play field makes a call to the server, and it says, I want you to tell me all of the requests that are coming in. How many messages per second are you getting through? Give me a dump of tell me all of the CPU and memory usages. And all of that gets aggregated onto the play field. And that's what the game is. So the game is that the browser just sits there and sends data up to the server. And the server part just charts out all of the graphs. But to test this to 2,000 users, we'd have to open 2,000 browsers. So then we thought, how are we going to actually get 2,000 WebSockets going? So we built a mechanism into the control panel where we can broadcast to all of the clients and say, I want you to step up and open a second WebSocket connection. So if I had two browsers open and I hit the button from the control panel, the browsers would establish two WebSockets to the server. The next time I hit the button, they're going to open another two WebSockets, and they'll have two sockets both going and sending to the server. And all of the messages multiplex on the client, and they all get sent up to the server. So I tested it locally, and I found that on running Chrome and Firefox and Internet Explorer, you could safely get about 10 or 15 WebSockets concurrently going from one browser without the data actually backing up on the client. So then we were left with the challenge that we needed to have about 200 browsers open to really do this. And look, I'm lucky that I work for a company like MYOB where there's 800 people employed. So I got on Yammer and I said, look, at 11:30 tomorrow morning, everybody needs to go to this web page, and it's really simple. All you need to do is open the web page, go off and have a cup of tea, and just do not touch the web page. If you've got to go to a meeting, leave your laptop plugged in, leave it wired into the internet, and whatever you do, don't close the browser. I will shut it down when I'm finished. So that was Yammer. I got an email. I sent a group email out to everybody. And then I put an invite in everybody's calendar, and I said, at 11:30, open this link.
And we got people in every office, and we have 7 offices, to run around at 11:30 and make sure everyone was doing it.
Yep. So we really wanted to, rather than ramping it all up through code and trying to open 2,000 sockets on one machine, I really wanted to try and spread this as evenly as I could to try and simulate what 2,000 web sockets would look like. So we got about 200 people on there, and I ramped up, one at a time, and it took about 15 minutes, and I got up to 2,000 concurrent users all on Azure. So the spec of the worker role we're using, it's a medium-sized worker role, so that's 3.2 gigs of RAM. So it's a pretty average machine. So the big spike here, you can actually see, you can read the times. This is 11:10, this is about 11:15 and 11:30. You can see we hit CPU percentage of about 89% on Azure, but the server kept going. It kept going. And I started to monitor the requests coming through, and the messages per second, we got up to 8,000 messages per second, and there wasn't a single message that got dropped between the client and the server. So the thing absolutely sung along. The chart down the bottom here, it's a little bit hard to read, but it's each one of those dots is it's a 30-second interval on how many messages have been processed on the server. And yeah, we got sort of on average between 10,000 and 20,000 messages every second throughput. So that's how we built the load testing. That was the load testing. And look, very, very happy with the results. And I think the proof was in the pudding, yeah. So it actually showed that the code we wrote was non-blocking, because clearly if we'd got blocking code up there somewhere where we were doing the aggregations of the totals, this thing would have just dropped off the planet after about a couple of hundred users.
Any questions on that? All right, so what we're going to do now is we're going to try and break the Pong record. There is no Australian Pong record. In fact, it was set yesterday at the keynote, the day before, right, with 59 users. So there's a please get laptops, get phones. During the keynote, what actually happened was the wireless got so clogged that it crashed twice. So everyone was kicked off. So this room we've chosen because there's a wireless access point in this one, and we can use the one next door. Apparently, we're hooked up close to it. So I don't know how many people in the room, but there's a number at the bottom. Why don't you bring up Pong? Bring up the same handset you had, and we're going to try and get the number out. So this is left versus right. You guys are on the left hand side. You guys are on the right hand side. You've got two buttons to choose from.
So try on the wireless, guys. If you can't get in on the wireless, try on 3G. So as you come on the screen,
I'm right.
I was going to ask you, you're on the right or the left-hand side of the room. So if you're on the left-hand side.
We've broken the record already. All right.
Okay. So left-hand side, as you're facing the screen, click the left-hand button, and right-hand side is right beside me.
The system is averaging it, right? If you half go up and half go down, it'll stay still. So maybe the back half kind of be the laggers, okay? You hold us back a little bit. And the front guys, push hard. All right, we can beat that. Should we speed it up?
We speed it up?
Yeah, speed it up. We got to put a speed button in
it's
there.
It's a dot, yeah?
Yeah, the dot. Yeah, the dot.
Okay.
All right, right-hand side. 76, we're at a new record. All right, beauty. Hey. Oh, no, up. Hey. All right,
guys.
86 players.
Everybody in the left.
All we need is this on video.
In the middle.
You can, and you can submit it to the Guinness Book of World Records on their website.
I've played this before. Down a little. Yes.
All right. Let's center it, guys. Center it. Let's see if we can keep it stable in the middle. Not everyone at once. Down. Slowly, slowly. Not everyone down. Harvey, now!
Yeah.
Oh. Right place. No.
Down. Up.
Okay.
Are you guys ready for Warp Factor 2?
Up. Yeah. All right.
Are we going to speed the ball up or is
that
good?
Yeah, speed it up.
Just give me 1 second.
I'm speeding it up then.
Up. Okay, just wait there. Oh,
here it comes. I'm helping. 99 players. Can we have one more player? Is there one more player? We need to... Oh.
Down. Oh.
Okay. Easy.
You guys
easy,
are good
at pump. Easy. Oh. 92. We come on. We need a few more players. You in the door. Bring some players in. Down. Where are you? Down. No, slow. Down, slow. Yeah.
Up.
Up slightly. Oh. You guys living on the edge.
Down, guys. Down. Oh. Two all. This is pretty close.
Here we go. Up. Oh, it's
Has
very
everybody
fast.
Got on?
Stay in the middle. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Who's going to predict it? Where's it going to go?
Middle, guys. Middle.
Slow. Yes. Oh, sweet.
We got to go for Serena Williams on the baseline. She stays
I
in the
100.
Middle.
We need 100 players. Down. We need 100 players. 98. We need 100 players.
Down.
We need six more players.
We need six players for the century. Six players. I feel like I'm at an auction. Do I have six more players, please?
Come on, six players.
Just six.
Oh!
97, we need three.
Three players, come on.
Three for
players.
The century.
Two players. Two more players. Come on, we got to get to 100. Two players. Oh.
Oh, Dan. Oh. 94, 95.
Come on, we need a couple more players. Grab people in the hallway.
Somebody's messing with us here. Somebody keeps jumping in and jumping out.
97, three more, come on.
Yes.
98. 99, come on. What? Oh. All right, I think we've got 99. I'm happy with that.
So just a reminder again, so what's actually happening here? So every 100 milliseconds, your handset is sending your vote for where you think that paddle should be up to the server. And then depending whether you're on the left or the right-hand side, the game loop on the loop on the server is aggregating that data, passing it on to the play fields. This is another browser.
Hang on. Oh.
Oh,
yay!
Woo!
All right, mission accomplished. All right, well done. Cool. Back to Prezzo.
Prezzo. We're under the tools,
Thank
aren't
you.
We?
All right, there we go. Phew. All right, so just in summary here, to finish it up, you know, Aidan and I got off a plane on Tuesday, an hour before the keynote, and that was the first time we had seen each other since we started this project. I think there was a 45-minute overlap in a conference room once, but basically he's in Sydney, I'm in Melbourne, and we never met. But gee, did we collaborate, right? The center of our world was GitHub, right? That was the source of truth between him and I. But we
every means possible.
I think we used 100 communication tools. Like we used Office Communicator, and we used
SMS.
Skype, and we used SMS.
Mobile phones.
And mobile phones. And I used iMessage on the Mac, and he was using Windows. We were using, you know, different editors. We tried to do this on zero budget, right? We didn't want to spend a dollar. and we got to it until about
two hours ago.
Two hours ago, our first cost got incurred. Who wants to guess what our first cost was?
Azure.
Correct. No, Azure's free, isn't it?
So true story, so I opened a 30-day trial account to build this on Azure, and I had 3 days left on my subscription, and we pushed the golden bill to Azure just 2 hours before this, and I hit the, through PowerShell, I did the deploy, and it just came up in red. I was like, oh my God, what's happening? So I looked, and I read the little message, and it said, access denied. Or what did it say? Your subscription has been suspended. So I logged in, and I looked, and I just tipped over the compute price, or the compute hours that I had assigned to me. So I whipped out the credit card, and I think my bill for all of this is probably going to be about 50 cents for what we've done here today. But yeah, so that was the goal. We didn't want to spend a dime, so we collaborated on GitHub. All of the tools we used were, we either begged, borrowed, and stealed, or they were open source.
Top left there is Agile Bench. It's an agile tool where you can, you know, track cards, etc. The guy there said, okay, for the project, you can have free accounts for the duration of your project. So not very nice of him there.
GitHub needs no introduction. Our favorite Octocache, that's where all the code is. And we're going to show you a URL at the end. We've open sourced all of this. If you guys want to fork the code, write a game, and just give us a push, we'll put it into the build. We'd love to see some games. HTML5, so we tried to stay pure to our goal of just JavaScript on the client, on the server, and HTML5. So all of the rendering in Pong where you saw the paddles and the ball, that was all the canvas tag. The political worm where we saw the real-time bullshit detector, that was the canvas tag.
jQuery served us pretty well. I mean, we tried to use it just to help us do the cross-browser stuff, right? Instead of doing document.get element by ID, etc. And there was one case with one browser during the quiz that it wouldn't display the right value, and it was some form of weird browser bug, and so we couldn't use jQuery for that call. We had to go back to grassroots on the JavaScript, which is fine. It didn't break any of our rules, but it was just like, you know, one of those quirks when you try to do cross-platform development. What's Flot?
Flot's a plugin to jQuery, so it's called jQuery Flot, and it's for charting. So all the data I got back for the load testing, I was able to get real-time graphs coming, and I got JSON messages coming back from the server, and you can just bind those to jQuery Flot, and it gives you beautiful real-time graphs.
The Reveal.js is this presentation software. So to build the presentation, we wrote a game, right, on our own platform. Did anyone follow along on the handset with the thing? Did that work? Was that cool? I mean, was it interesting? We tried to put interesting information in there. Okay, cool. So we used Reveal, which is it node-based or just a generic JavaScript?
No, it's generic JavaScript, and that's on GitHub as well.
So we embedded that in a play field, and it hooked in for when you change the slide to send a custom message through our library to the servers, to the handsets, to update to the client-side version of the slides, which were just our div swapping mechanism that we did for the clients. We did the same thing for client-side slide in the game.
Okay.
I think that's it, isn't it?
That's it, guys.
Are we there?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyone questions? Yeah, no, we have 220 developers at MYOB. 95% of them are full-time employees. So, yeah, we do all our own development, and we try to do a lot of innovation, and we try to, you know, stay on top of what's going on so that we can include these technologies in our software. You know, obviously we're accounting, so this is not really accounting, and, you know, don't tell my boss that I've made a Pong game, and, you know.
He's the boss.
That's okay. Tell my boss. Yeah. That's all right. No, but, you know, I think this is, this comes under the banner of business software. I think this software, let me finish. Let me try this one. I'm practicing my speech for my boss, all right? So let's try, tell me how this goes. So we believe that this kind of software and these interactions will start to appear more and more in crowd environments with a single screen at conferences. Why not? Why not engage the audience in different ways? How are we going to engage them, and what is going to be the model? I don't think anyone knows yet, but I think these kind of platforms will allow that to be done, and it certainly will be enhancing the business life for people. And, you know, one of MYB's missions are, you know, to making business software, making business life easier. So how'd that sound? No, he's not going to buy it. It's Pong. Thank you all. Thank you very much.